Welcome to the March 12th, 2024 meeting of the Colorado River Basin Regional Water Quality Control Board. For everyone joining us in the meeting room, please turn off or silence your cell phones. This meeting is being webcasted and recorded, so please speak clearly. This meeting is being conducted in a physical location and is also available via remote access. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. For those in the Zoom meeting, you will be muted with your camera off until it is your turn to speak. The host will then unmute you and ask you to turn off your camera if you have one. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will be placed on mute and your camera turned off. You can remain in the Zoom meeting until the completion of your item and then may choose to exit the meeting or continue. All right. Board Member Perez, would you mind leading us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, before we continue, will the clerk please do a roll call?
Chair Satin?
Present.
Vice Chair Perez?
Present.
Board Member Gonzalez? Absent. Board Member Music?
Present.
Board Member Wright?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. All right. The purpose of this public meeting is for regional board members to obtain testimony and information from concerned and affected parties within the Colorado River Basin region regarding water quality issues. We welcome hearing from the public at this meeting. Any person wishing to speak should have submitted a speaker request as described in the agenda instructions. For those items listed on today's agenda, you will make your comments at the time the item is being considered. If you wish to speak on an item that is not on the agenda, you may speak now during the public forum. Comments will generally be limited to 3 minutes. The board clerk can now identify the speakers who have submitted speaker cards for the public forum. Do we have any comments?
Yes, we do, Chair Music. I mean, sorry, Chair Satin. My apology. First one is Sarah Rapola. Oh, you went. Oh, okay, that's fine. Sorry. Okay, Zoe Rodriguez Del Rey.
Testing. Perfect. So good morning, everyone. My name is Zoe Rodriguez Del Rey. I am the Water Resources Manager at Coachella Valley Water District. And I really appreciate the opportunity to come before the board to provide some comments on an item that's not on the agenda. Coachella Valley Water District operates 5 wastewater treatment plants, including Water Reclamation Plant 10 in Palm Desert, which also provides recycled water for landscape irrigation. There is a tentative order that has been published for our Warp 10 facility with a 30-day public comment period. We requested that that public hearing be moved to provide sufficient time for staff to evaluate comments, as we expect there to be quite a few comments on this tentative order. And we want to thank the regional board staff for continuing that to the May 19th meeting. The May meeting. But we would also like to request that the public comment period be extended to provide adequate time for Coachella Valley Water District and other interested parties to evaluate and provide comments on the tentative order. The Warp 10 tentative order has far-reaching implications, not just for Coachella Valley Water District and its sanitation customers, whose rates could increase by as much as 60% as a result of this order, but also for other sanitation agencies currently or planning in the future to provide recycled water, for water resources management in the Coachella Valley Water District, as well as for the CVS and MP development process, which is underway in collaboration between all of the water and wastewater agencies in the Coachella Valley, working to implement the work plan that has been approved by the Regional Water Board. Having more time to evaluate impacts of the tentative order on stakeholders across the Coachella Valley is very important. Given the significant implications of the tentative order and public interest in this matter, we respectfully request that the public comment period be extended through the end of April to ensure that all stakeholders have adequate time to provide comments, to ensure that the decision-making process is transparent, inclusive, and promotes public participation. As a separate matter, we're seeking clarification if this item will be heard on April 9th or just automatically continued so that we can properly prepare. Thank you.
Go ahead. Thank you for your comment. Go ahead.
All right. just by a little bit of way of background in terms of process, regional board staff developed an initial permit, draft permit, and as consistent with other facilities, what we did was we provided CVWD with an opportunity to make review it and make red lines. We incorporated some of those red lines, and then we posted it for a public comment. As of right now, it is set to be heard in May, on May 14th, and the CVWD came back to us and said we would like, we think we're going to have a lot of comments and we think you'll need more time. So please move it from the April meeting. I think it was originally supposed to be April. Admittedly, that was going to be a little tight on our part in terms of the end of the public comment period. And, you know, versus the hearing time, we typically get a lot of great feedback from CVWD, and it's always a very interesting and engaging process developing a permit with them. And so we expect that, you know, we would need more time. So we did agree to push it. And then we did receive a request for an extension last week. We have not provided a response yet. Although, are we inclined? We haven't made a decision on that quite yet, but we're looking to be fair and consistent with other permits in that regard. And we are going to be providing response very soon.
When would the public comment period over?
The public comment period was not extended. So it started out as 30 days, and it still ends on April 2nd, which would be about a month between the current hearing date of May 14th, just over a little over a month. So there is some room there.
Are there any additional comments?
Yes, Sarah Rapola.
Good morning, board staff. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Sarah Rapola, and I am the Senior Water Resources Specialist for Desert Water Agency. We appreciate the opportunity to come before you today. Desert Water Agency is one of two active recycled water purveyors in the Coachella Valley. Expanding recycled water has always been an important component of our water management strategy. It is part of the groundwater sustainability plans and alternatives that we're working on. We are also helping, along with other agencies throughout the valley, to develop the Coachella Valley Salt Nutrient Management Plan. We appreciate the regional board staff's engagement in that process to date. We have reviewed the tentative order for Coachella Valley Water District and are concerned that this order could impact the feasibility of recycled water delivery and expansion in the valley. In the past several years, Desert Water Agency has worked hard to keep recycled water users on board given rising costs. It is critical that recycled water remain cost-effective for our customers. Having more time to evaluate the impacts of this permit on stakeholders across the Coachella Valley is very important. We would like, along with Coachella Valley, to see a longer public comment period to enable everyone throughout the valley to make those comments, which are very important to this process. We also see so much value in the salt nutrient management plan process and appreciate any opportunity to align with that. Thank you.
Any further comments?
No, we do not.
Thank you.
Just like to make a comment. I just ask you guys on the extending of the public hearing that Zoe was talking about. It's a month and a half now between meeting and public hearing. And is the month and a half necessary? Could you give them another week or two to extend the public comment period, or is that interfere with what you're trying to do?
We're still looking at it, Nancy. I think we're open to some time. I'm not sure that through April, the end of April, it works for us, given the expected number of comments we may need to respond to.
Okay.
So we'll get back to them with adjustment.
Okay.
Any further questions from the board? Awesome. Okay, we now move on to agenda item 3, which is the review and approval of the minutes for the board's prior meeting of February 13th, 2024. Do I have a motion to approve?
So moved.
A second?
I'll second.
All right, I have a motion and a second. Can I please hear a roll call vote?
Chair Satin?
Aye.
Vice Chair Perez?
Aye.
Board Member Gonzalez?
Aye.
Board Member Music?
Aye.
Board Member Wright?
Aye.
Motion carries.
I'd like to note for the record that Board Member Gonzalez has arrived. Okay, so moving on to the State Board Liaison Update for Agenda Item 4. The board will now hear an update from Ms. Laurel Firestone, our liaison to the State Water Resources Control Board.
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure can.
Oh, great. Great. Good to see you all remotely. I have a number of things I want to update you on. First is we at our first March meeting adopted a resolution regarding the proposed prioritization of drinking water regulations that are in development for this calendar year. And that resolution is really meant to give a preview for suppliers and the public, really, on our priorities that include adopting, first and foremost, an MCL on hexavalent chromium, which I'll talk about, but also work on PFOA and PFOS, arsenic, and we at least consideration and advancing of those, and also working on on-site treatment and reuse and lead copper roll revision implementation, as well as detection limits. So these are things that we want to make sure the whole water sector is anticipating are being worked on and can be helping to plan projects accordingly. We have been working, as everyone knows, on hexavalent chromium maximum contaminant level for a very long time. But we are we just finished an extended public comment period from additional documents mostly that were released January 31st of this year. The public comment deadline was March 4th, and we are looking to take this up hopefully next month. If we approved the regulations, it then goes to finance and the Office of Administrative Law, but it could still become effective this fall if we're taking it up this spring. So that's our current plan. I will keep you posted. I know it's a huge issue in this region that folks have been dealing with for a long time. We also did a update from staff on progress made on the first year of implementation of our racial equity action plan. And we have a really great annual report that outlines a number of things and also that were accomplished this year, as well as priorities for the coming year. So I'll make sure folks get that, but it's I think goes into a lot of detail about the various areas of work we're doing, both internally in terms of our workforce, as well as within our program areas. We are continuing to work on how to adjust to the budget situation, and the proposed budget that the governor released on January 10th significantly delays and reduces the amount of general fund appropriation for water recycling and groundwater cleanup. And so we will be considering potential grant limit reductions for construction projects that are being in the process on our fundable list. And we'll be considering those changes at our next board meeting on March 19th. And we've received public comments and been working with Water Reuse and CASA and others to try and make sure that we're still supporting recycled water and groundwater cleanup projects moving forward. The good news is we do have a lot of federal funding coming in, but general fund right now, there's a lot of strain because of the budget. And so that provides some need to really consider, will we fund one project or spread the money over a number of projects, and how do we prioritize that? So that we'll be considering on March 19th. We also just released our agenda for that March 19th and 20th meeting and workshop, and we'll be holding on the 20th a workshop on the water use efficiency package. So this is the legislation, implementation of the legislation that requires us to establish unique efficiency goals for the more than 400 urban retail water suppliers in the state. And the goal is to ensure that suppliers have the flexibility to implement solutions that are most appropriate for their communities. But it will require those suppliers to calculate and adhere to water use budgets, implement commercial, industrial, and institutional performance measures, and submit annual progress reports. We had a very long meeting on October 4th and took written comments on the first draft. Since then, we've been working to convene about 21 meetings with 5 working groups in an effort to really dial in this regulatory framework and have a revised text that should be released, I believe, today. And we'll have another 15-day comment period on that, really looking to fine-tune this package. And we'll receive more public comments and discussion at our workshop on March 20th. As usual, our distribution list, the LIRIS, and our program page will have more information when that goes out. And I'm also available to help Region 7 navigate things if you have questions. The other thing that we're looking at coming up, particularly of interest to this region, is the Salt and Sea Workshop. Right now, the plan is looking like it will be May 22nd. Unfortunately, due to our budget constraints, looks like we're going to need to hold this one in Sacramento at Cali PA, but there will be opportunity for public comment to be delivered remotely. And there'll be an opportunity for participants to provide input to the state board regarding the status of the Solvency Management Program. We will provide more information and a notice soon that has more information on how we're hoping to facilitate participation, even though we won't be in person in the sea, which of course is our preference, but just given the constraints we're under this year. So I'll provide more information soon on that when we release a notice. And then just more broadly with us coming up at the state board, we have a lot going on with SGMA, Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. We have a staff workshop in the Tule Subbasin, which would be the second subbasin we would be considering for probation on April 8th. And we have a hearing in Sacramento to determine whether the Tulare Lake subbasin will be put on probation under our authorities through SGMA on April 16th. So that would be the first subbasin to go under probation. Probation triggers groundwater pumping reporting requirements and fees. And after a year of being in probation, there's the potential for the water board to adopt an interim plan to restrict pumping. After that, at the end of April 24th through 26th, we'll have a 3-day workshop on voluntary agreements in the Bay Delta plan. So we have a lot coming up at the state board, and I just wanted to give you a taste of that, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from board members? I have one maybe for our board regarding the Salton Sea workshop now apparently taking place in Sacramento. Can we look into the opportunity to host a public forum, a viewing here in this boardroom concurrently with that to allow, you know, public access?
Yeah, I'll work with the state board and see if that's an option. I know they probably will have viewing spots, so we'll see if we can do one here.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Laurel.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. The board will now move to the information items on today's agenda, starting with item 5. We will now hold a workshop on the proposed total maximum daily loads for pyrethroid pesticides in the Alamo and New Rivers. The purpose of this workshop is to solicit stakeholder and board member input and to encourage and facilitate a high level of interaction among the board members for discussing and providing direction to staff. The board welcomes public input on the items, and members of the public will have an opportunity to provide comments. As such, electronic speaker card requests were submitted prior to the meeting, and speaker cards were also collected at the meeting. To ensure a productive and efficient workshop, oral comments may be limited to 3 minutes at the discretion of the board chair. This is informational item only. Although Colorado River Basin Water Board members are present, no board action will be taken on this informational item. The board will, however, have an opportunity to ask questions and provide comments. The order of speakers for this agenda first are as follows. First, there will be a presentation by Regional Water Board staff, Raveline Cower. Next, the board will hear any comments from the public. Finally, the board will have an opportunity to make their own comments on the matter. I understand Ms. Cower is participating remotely. Do we have her ready to go?
Yes, we do. Raveline, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, the floor is yours.
Good morning, Chair Sadden and members of the board. Before I begin, I would like to thank the board for giving me the opportunity to participate in this board meeting virtually. My name is Raveline Kaur, and I'm an environmental scientist at the Colorado River Basin Regional Water Quality Control Board. Today, I'll be presenting a proposed basin plan amendment to the Water Quality Control Plan for the Colorado River Basin, and this is to establish total maximum daily loads, which are also called as TMDLs, an implementation plan for pyrethroid pesticides in the Alamo River and New River in Imperial County. Next slide, please. So this is the outline for the workshop today. I'll start the presentation with a brief description of the regulatory background driving this action and an overview of the Water Quality Control Plan, also known as Basin Plan, for the Colorado River Basin region. Then I'll go over the project objective and overview, which will cover the water quality objectives and allocation loadings. This will then be followed by a discussion on the stakeholder involvement and describing the scientific peer review process. And finally, I will address the project implementation steps for this basin plan amendment that will be presented to the board for consideration during the upcoming board meeting on May 14th, 2024. Next slide, please. So to begin with, the state of California is required by both federal and state law to protect water quality within the state. The state responsibilities are outlined at the federal level with the Federal Clean Water Act and at the state level with the Port of Colon Water Quality Act. The state law grants authority to the State Water Resources Control Board and the Regional Water Quality Control Boards and establishes responsibilities pertaining to the waters of the state. The mission of the California Water Boards is to preserve, enhance, and restore the quality of waters for current and future generations. Total maximum daily loads, or TMDLs, which is what this workshop is about, are a requirement of the Federal Clean Water Act. These TMDLs are implemented to improve surface assess water quality by placing allocations on the amounts of a pollutant that can be discharged to a water body. Implementing TMDLs ensures that beneficial users are protected and water quality standards are met. In this figure, this is a map of a region and the salt and sea area of regional water quality control board 7. Next slide, please. The water quality control plan, referred to as the basin plan, is the central regulatory document for ensuring water quality in the Colorado River Basin region. It outlines regional specific plans and policies in effect. The basin plan contains beneficial users, water quality objectives to protect the beneficial users, implementation agreements, monitoring plans, and other policies in effect. Please note, as a living document, this is subject to changes as needed to reflect the current status of water bodies or revised objectives. A basin plan amendment is required to change any part of the basin plan and must be approved by the Regional Water Board, the State Water Board, the Office of Administrative Law, and when necessary, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, also called as U.S. EPA. Establishing a TMDL must go through the process of this basin plan amendment to be incorporated in the basin plan. Next slide, please. Here's a quick guide to understand how this and all the other basin plan amendment process works. A basin plan amendment is required for any proposed changes to the basin plan. Initially, we identify the need for the amendment. In this case, the need for this amendment is identified. The next step is to contact any tribes with historical or ancestral ties in the project area and inform them of the potential project, offer them with an opportunity for tribal consultation. Following the tribal consultation, or if there is no request for consultation, we begin CEQA scoping, which is the California Environmental Quality Act scoping. After this, we develop the draft of the basin plan amendment. The draft amendment then goes through the process of scientific peer review. After peer review, the amendment will be presented at both a public workshop and a public hearing for consideration, first by the Regional Water Board and then by the State Water Board. This provides additional opportunity for public input. So before going into effect, the amendment will need to be approved by the OAL and US EPA. This workshop is a part of the Regional Water Board approval process and is to introduce the Regional Water Board to the proposed amendment to the basin plan for establishing TMDL for pyrethroid pesticides in the Alamo River and New River in Imperial County. Next slide, please. A TMDL is the calculation of the maximum amount of a pollutant allowed to enter a water body so that the water body will meet and continue to meet water quality standards for that particular pollutant. This slide lists the element that must be included in a TMDL. A completed TMDL must include a problem statement that describes which water quality standards are not being attained, which beneficial users are impaired, and the nature of the impairment, numeric targets that define measurements to ensure recovery of the beneficial users that are impaired and attainment of standards, source analysis, which identifies the amount, timing, and point of origin of pollutants of concern, allocations that distribute responsibility and identifies the parties to take the specified actions. So allocations from from point sources are assigned waste load allocations, whereas the allocations from non-point sources are assigned load allocations. An implementation plan that describes what actions will be taken to reduce the impairment. Next is the linkage analysis that determines how the numeric targets relate to the problem and how the actions taken can help achieve water quality standards. Then we have a monitoring or reevaluation plan that describes the monitoring strategy that will be used. And finally, a TMDL needs to include a margin of safety, which is a component that accounts for the uncertainty about the relationship between the pollutant load and quality of the receiving water. The margin of safety may be implicit by using conservative assumptions, or it could also be explicit through a discrete allocation assigned to the margin of safety. Next slide, please. This project is located in the Imperial Valley, which covers approximately 500,000 acres south of the Salton Sea and is mostly irrigated agricultural land. The Alamo River and New River are surface water bodies in the Imperial Valley that are polluted or impaired by pyrethroid pesticides that are toxic to both humans and aquatic life. Looking at the figure on the left, these bright blue lines indicate these two rivers located in the Salton Sea transboundary watershed. The pink shaded area is the New River watershed, whereas the yellow shaded area is the Alamo River watershed. Next slide, please. So moving on to the project objectives, the Regional Water Board is proposing to amend the basin plan for establishing TMDLs for pyrethroid pesticides in the Alamo River and New River in Imperial County. Based on the Clean Water Act Section 303D Impaired Waters List and the General Pyrethroids Listing, these six different pyrethroids, namely bifenthrin, cyfluthrin, cypermethrin, esfenvalerate, lambda cyhalothrin, and permethrin form the basis of this TMDL. Next slide, please. Now to calculate the numeric targets and baseload allocations for all these six pyrethroids, the methodology that our staff has adopted includes using the updated UC Davis method, which is essentially the water quality criteria report for establishing the water column targets, and the median lethal concentrations method for sediment targets. So for water column targets, water quality criteria report, also abbreviated as WQCR, was used, which is a peer-reviewed report and was updated by the Central Valley Regional Water Board to include the recently generated toxicity data in the previously accepted version of UC Davis method. And the additive toxicity method was used for calculating the numeric targets for these pyrethroid pesticides co-occurring in the water sample. So this just means that if a constituent chemical have a same mode of action, their toxicity normalized concentrations can be added to estimate the effective concentration. The sediment targets, on the other hand, were based on median lethal concentrations for each pyrethroid normalized by the percentage of organic carbon. Next slide, please. The water quality objectives selected for Alamo and New Rivers are determined by the designated beneficial uses included in the basin plan. Beneficial uses are designated according to the typical use of a water body, and the most protective beneficial uses are those that protect both human life and aquatic life. Both water bodies are designated for wildlife habitat, water contact recreation, warm freshwater habitat, freshwater replenishment, water non-contact recreation, and rare, endangered, or threatened species. So these are the beneficial uses associated with these water bodies. Next slide, please. For these TMDLs, allocations for pyrethroid pesticides are based on source analysis and numeric targets. Loads are allocated among various sources of pollutants and characterized as either non-point sources or point sources, as shown in the figure here. Non-point source pollution occurs when runoff carries pollutants from the land, roads, and buildings into drainage, ditches, lakes, rivers, and other water sources, and the discharge is unidentifiable. To identify the loading capacity allocated to existing and future non-point sources, non-point sources are assigned load allocations. Point source pollution occurs when pollutants are discharged into conveyances such as pipes, drains, and ditches, and the source of pollution is identifiable. Point sources such as factories, sewage treatment plants, and concentrated animal feeding operations are subject to regulations under the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System Program, also known as the NPDES program, to identify the loading capacity allocated to existing and future point sources, point sources are assigned waste load allocations as shown here. Next slide, please. So a review of the collected water quality data from Alamo River and the New River between 2003 to 2020 indicates the presence of pyrethroid compounds in the water column samples, and their concentrations frequently exceeded numeric targets, which was the main factor for listing these water bodies. The pyrethroid concentrations found in sediment samples between 2003 to 2020 did not exceed the numeric targets. But to address these impairments and to protect benthic and aquatic organisms, wildlife, and human health from the potentially harmful effects of pyrethroid compounds, the allocations of pyrethroid compounds have been set equal to the numeric targets and will be implemented in permits as waste load and load allocations in both Alamo and New Rivers. Next slide, please. As the next step to facilitate the stakeholders' involvement, stakeholders were involved throughout the TMDL's development. Letters were sent out to California Native American tribes with historical or ancestral ties in the project area to inform them of the potential project and offer an opportunity for tribal consultation. The regional board did not receive any requests for consultation. So on February 25th, 2022, a CEQA scoping meeting was held to introduce the project to stakeholders and receive feedback on potential issues that might arise, including impacts, mitigation measures, alternatives, or compliance. Next slide, please. Regional Water Board staff are also required to submit the scientific basis and scientific portion of all the proposed policies, plans, and regulations for external scientific review. Staff asked the reviewers to comment on whether the scientific portions of the TMDL staff report and implementation plan are based upon sound scientific knowledge, methods, and practice. Specifically, the reviewers were asked to comment on these five specific areas. The first one, whether the selection of numeric targets for pyrethroid compounds are adequate in protecting the beneficial uses of the Imperial Valley waters. The second one was to whether the source analysis of the pyrethroid compound pollution in impaired surface waters were identified. Third, whether the proposed load and waste load allocations are accurate. Fourth, whether the proposed implementation is accurate and effective. Fifth, whether the proposed monitoring plan is accurate and effective. So through the University of California's facilitated peer review selection process, two individuals were collective technical expertise in pesticide pollution, toxicity, fate, transport, and irrigated agriculture were selected to review this document for the scientific adequacy. The external scientific reviewers determined the scientific portions of the TMDL staff report and implementation plan were based on scientific knowledge, methods, and practices. Their comments were addressed and the scientific peer review process was completed in December 2023. Next slide, please. Moving on to the implementation part, this TMDL will be implemented through our regional water board's Imperial Valley Agricultural General Order for Non-Point Sources of Pollution and the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, also known as NPDES, permits for point sources of pollution. The general order is implemented through our region's Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program, which establishes the general waste discharge requirements for agricultural discharges that are members of a coalition group in the Imperial Valley. This general order also includes the Water Quality Management Plan or FARM plan, which outlines the management practices on irrigated agricultural land to minimize or prevent the discharge of wastes to waters of the state. Furthermore, the water quality restoration plans are triggered by exceedances and require a water board's approved improvement plan. For point sources, NPDES permits, municipalities, facilities will be regulated through the permits for their discharges to the New River and Alamo River. NPDES permitted municipalities and facilities were identified as uncertain sources of pyrethroid pollution because their existing monitoring programs did not include monitoring for pyrethroids. But through the implementation of these TMDLs, the facilities will utilize the requirements put in place through either individual or general NPDES permits or waste discharge requirements, and therefore monitor for pyrethroid compounds in their effluent water. Next slide, please. For this project, the board has provided the draft basin plan amendment and the draft staff report. At this time, Regional Water Board staff are not asking the board to vote on the adoption of the basin plan amendment. We are just providing information and encouraging public comment on the TMDLs and proposed basin plan amendment. The basin plan amendment is scheduled to be presented to the board for consideration on May 14th, 2024. Next slide, please. Lastly, the draft documents associated with this amendment were posted for public review on February 26, 2024. The public comment period is being held open for 45 days and will end on April 10, 2024. Comments are being accepted electronically by email, hand and mail deliveries, and through fax as well. If you would like to submit a comment or more information on how to submit a comment, my contact information is provided on this slide. Next slide, please. With this, I would like to thank each one of you for your time and attendance. If you would like to submit a written comment, my contact information is provided on this slide. As a reminder, written comments will be accepted through April 10th, 2024. Thank you, Chair Sadin, and this concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Coward. Do we have any public comments?
No, we do not.
Do we have any questions from the board?
I just got a question about there was a couple of different methods, like the update on the UC Davis method for water column targets. There was that was the choice from what I was reading. I remember that was choice of staff to choose that particular process. Also, I was wondering is the cost of implementing those type of methods. Was that part of your thought process in picking that one, or is that a pro? Is that even apply?
So I will go ahead and take this question. Yes, the motivation for choosing the UC Davis method for water column targets is because these are well-developed targets and they are also being used at one of the other water boards, as I mentioned, the Central Valley Board. So these water column targets that they have used and formed in the form of the water quality criteria report are the ones that also matches up with the condition at the Imperial Valley. So we specifically asked the peer reviewers to look at the scientific basis of these targets and make sure that we can use these targets for the waters in our region, and they agreed to that. For the implementation cost and plans, we are still looking into it, and we have considered that it is going to be regulated through NPDES permits as well as the agricultural orders. So I think with all the other monitoring that the farmers or the egg orders are doing right now, it's just an addition of these few more pyrethroids in their plan. I hope that answers your question.
If I could clarify, your question was whether or not the dischargers would be using this methodology. Is that correct?
No, it was the choice of our staff that chose that method. When I was reading it, that's what I came up with. Anyway, just wondering if that was part of the process, was looking at the cost.
The cost to...
to implement this type of method.
So the dischargers will not be using this method. No. Ravelin, can you explain that?
Yes, sure. So no, this method was just to get the numeric targets to come up with the numbers for these total maximum daily loads that they will be required, that are the basis for the discharges in the waters. So this is just the scientific method that we used for getting the numbers for the numeric targets for the allowable limits. They are not going to use these methods. They will more be concerned about making sure that they are not discharging their waters with these pyrethroids at those levels. So this was just for the scientific part. It is a publication, and we use that to get our numbers.
Right. Okay. So I guess I was thinking that if they had to use those targets, if those targets had a cost efficiency for implementation, I guess, behind them, but maybe that's not an appropriate question on this, but just wanted to make sure.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. This was just for the scientific basis to get the numbers, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do we have any other questions? I just have one regarding timeline. So we're in the process of the public workshop. What's the, from this point forward through US EPA approval, how long does that usually take?
It takes a long time.
Yeah.
Sometimes things get brought up later on. We're still, a couple of years ago, we adopted a TMDL. For
organochlorine.
OCOP. Yeah. I get into trouble when I start pronouncing things. Anyway, we are still dealing with, we got through State Water Board, and then we got through the Office of Administrative Law, because it's a quasi-legislative policymaking activity, regulatory rulemaking pretty much. And now we're at USEPA, and USEPA is now saying things like, you know, I don't really want to get specifics, but USEPA has added in new things like, oh, well, what about this issue? Well, would have been nice if you told us sooner, or, you know, those things. It takes a long time, but these things are very important, and it's important to just keep pushing forward through them, and, you know, they will get across the finish line.
So, and how do we handle in the interim? Do we, you know, start writing this in as like a future thing, or is this, you know, once it's,
well,
no action until all of a sudden there's action?
One of the things that some of these TMDLs have in common is that they plug into the existing framework of actions that we're already taking. And so it's a bit of a shift in terms of how we view things, but it does reflect a continuation of the actions that are already being taken in many respects, not every respect, but in many respects. So, you know, the amount of time that it takes to get them finally approved may not necessarily have any direct bearing, at least immediately, on you know, timelines.
Sure. Well, I certainly note that it sounds like Imperial Valley is already monitoring 3 of the 6. So that's, mm-hmm. that's good news. Awesome. Thank you, Ms. Kaur. And with that, so I can close the public workshop and move on to item 6. All right, so the board will now hear a presentation from Regional Water Board staff Monica Aragon on the Pacific Gas and Electric Topuc Compressor Station. This is an informational item only, and no actions will be taken. Ms. Aragon?
Good morning, board members. My name is Monica Aragon Guzman. I am an engineering geologist for Region 7. With the site cleanup and underground storage tank unit. And I'm also the caseworker for the PG&E Topuc Compressor Station. Today, I would like to introduce to you Mr. Ian Baker with Pacific Gas and Electric Company, also known as PG&E. He is bringing us an update on the status of groundwater and the groundwater remedy for the PG&E Topuc Compressor Station, and introducing his presentation named Protecting the Colorado River. Mr. Ian Baker is the manager for environmental remediation with PG&E, one of the largest utility companies in the United States based out of Oakland, California. Mr. Baker has over 25 years of diverse environmental experience in the industry, starting as an environmental consultant for both government and private industry clients. He transitioned to PG&E as an in-house remediation expert, where he has been for the last 9 years. Through his career, he has specialized in soil and groundwater remediation, and in his current role, he oversees PG&E's chromium remediation program at the PG&E Topak Compressor Station, where nearly 40% of California's natural gas supply enters the PG&E system. The compressor station is located in Needles, California, approximately 15 miles southeast, and in an area of important tribal and cultural significance. Here's Mr. Ian Baker.
Is there a clicker? You do it on cue? Okay. Good morning. As Monica mentioned, my name is Ian Baker. I'm a manager for chromium remediation with PG&E, so really supporting our two big hexavalent chromium cleanups, Hinkley and Topak. And I'm here today to give you an update on where we're at with our Topak remediation project. Go to the next slide, please. So today we're going to look at kind of an overview of our whole environmental program. We're going to talk about the groundwater remedy that we're implementing, the progress on that remedy, and then also get into some soil investigation and removal actions that we've completed at the site to date. And then I'll open it up for questions anyone might have on the project. Next slide, please. So we'll start with the environmental program overview. Go to the next one, please. And really just provide the setting of the Topak compressor station. So as Monica mentioned, the Topak compressor station is located just outside of Needles, right at the Arizona-Topak border. And the purpose of that facility is that as gas is pushed through a pipeline, it needs to be recompressed every 200 to 300 miles to have adequate pressure to push it through the pipe. So this is the first of our three compressor stations that move this gas into our service territory. That process involves really large compressor engines that generate a ton of heat. And especially in this desert environment where we can see temperatures that are 120 degrees, it requires a lot of cooling. And so that process, basically we use big cooling towers, but we use hexavalent chromium as an anti-corrosion product to save the metal in those towers. And at the time it was the industry standard that was discharged when it was spent into basically an unlined wash behind the compressor station. Given the sandy nature of the soils, all of that water really migrated down into the subsurface aquifer and created the plume that we see today. The other, as Monica mentioned, the other thing is this entire area is considered of extreme sacred significance to multiple Native American tribes. So that, you know, any sort of activities at the site could be considered a desecration. And therefore we try to minimize impact that we have to cause to the land by doing this remediation. So it's just an added layer of complexity that most sites don't have. Next slide, please. So in terms of our overall goals, you know, we want to get the cleanup done for both the soil and groundwater contamination. We want to protect public health. In this case, really, that's primarily the Colorado River. We also want to protect the environment and the cultural resources, the significant amount of cultural resources that exist at this site, all, you know, complying with our regulatory requirements, engaging with the tribes as we can to try to get to consensus on how to do this work, and then do it safely, efficiently. Next slide, please. So we have a lot of different stakeholders at this site. We have two primary regulatory agencies. That's the DTSC, is our lead state agency. And then we also have the DOI, who's our lead federal agency. Multiple agencies under each of those. There's a lot of federally owned land where this plume is. And so we deal with BLM, Bureau of Reclamation, kind of under the umbrella of the DOI as the lead agency. And then with regard to the state, obviously we have involvement from the Water Board, and we also have involvement from Arizona environmental agencies. And then we have six primary Native American tribes that actively participate in the project. And that's everything from working with us on design documents to avoid resources where we can, to also providing oversight of all our construction activities to make sure no artifacts are impacted. So we have quite a bit of participation on this project and a lot of interaction and consultations that happen throughout it. Next slide, please. So next I'm going to talk about the groundwater, kind of the history of how we got to this groundwater remedy, what the remedy actually looks like, and then a little later in the presentation we'll talk about how it functions. Next slide, please. So from 1951 to 2003, this is when all the initial discharges of hexavalent chromium occurred. Hexavalent chromium was used into the 80s, but the policy of discharging untreated water into the wash behind the station ended in 1964, and that's when we started treating the water before we discharged it. So really, we're talking about the period from 1951 to 1964 when this release occurred. And that's when we started some initial conversations with agencies and started some initial investigation. As we get in the 2004 to 2010 period, we continued doing investigation, discovered that hexavalent chromium was present near the Colorado River. So in order to protect the river, some interim actions were completed throughout that period of time, which really involved pumping the water from down by the river, treating it, and either disposing of it or reinjecting it. That varied over time. There was three different interim actions that occurred. That also led to increased tribal engagement. And then as we get into 2011-2017 timeframe, we really started evaluating what the final remedy would look like, worked with the tribes and the agencies to come to an agreement on the best way to clean this up with the minimal impacts at that time. And then into 2018, we started building this remedy, which has been constructed in two phases. So phase one was completed in 2021 and began operating. And I'll show you what that system consists of. And that allowed us to turn off our interim system. And then we also began phase two of the remedy construction in 2022. And that's kind of ongoing with a current slight pause right now as we evaluate some improvements that we think can be made to the overall remedy. Next slide, please. So this has some, you know, key facts at different dates about the remedy on the slide that you're looking at, but I'd really like to focus, if you look at the plume map that you're seeing adjacent to the text, in 2015, the plume looked much larger. That was for a couple different reasons. One was there was a significant amount of data gaps. We didn't know exactly where the plume was. We couldn't put that many monitoring wells in because we were trying to avoid impacts to the site. So there were some significant data gaps. The other thing is, as we operated those interim systems, we actually did pull the plume back and treat, 8,000 pounds of chromium that existed in that area over that interim period of time. So, the combination of those two things resulted in a much smaller plume footprint. And at PG&E, we feel like the remedy design as it is now is really inefficient because a lot of the infrastructure is quite far away from the plume. It was put into place for this much larger plume and just creates a really kind of inefficient remediation that requires a lot of unnecessary infrastructure. Next slide, please. So the way the final remedy was designed is you could see that green shaded area on the figure that we're looking at. That's what we call an in situ reactive zone. It really is, we're creating a reactive barrier to treat the hexavalent chromium. And the way that works is we inject ethanol into the aquifer. That provides a food source for naturally occurring microbes. And as that microbial population grows, it creates this reducing environment. When hexavalent chromium comes in contact with the reducing environment, it changes into trivalent chromium. So basically, it gets an extra electron, changes to trivalent chromium, which is non-toxic. It also is not very water soluble. So it actually precipitates out of the water, becomes part of the soil, and basically remains out of the water. So the concept here is that you build this reducing barrier. Then you have these other wells that you see in the northern portion of the site and down by the station, and you create this push. So you inject water into those upgradient injection wells, create a push that pushes all of the hexavalent chromium contamination into this reducing zone and treats it. A large part of why we chose this type of system is there's a lot of sacred areas in the middle here where we can't put infrastructure. And so this allows everything to push through. There's some other safeguards like extraction wells along the river that if we needed to, because chromium either got through our barrier or some of the byproducts that get created by the reducing conditions go towards the river, we'd pump those wells and recirculate water to protect the river. So really that's the concept that we're going for. So I think we can go on to the next slide. So in terms of what's been built to date, phase one construction is all done. That's all those wells along that that green shaded line. It's actually called National Trails Highway. All of those injection and extraction wells that form that what we call the IRZ, an in situ reactive zone, but really the reducing barrier, has been installed. And then during phase two, what we're calling phase 2A, we've constructed some of the upland infrastructure for that push I was describing. The infrastructure we haven't installed to date is in the areas where we think it's not necessary, it's inefficient, it's too far away, and we're working on a redesign concept with the tribes and agencies to see if we can make this more efficient. And it actually looks like we can do the cleanup faster by just putting the infrastructure closer to the plume and getting that done. It's a challenging site. It's very tricky to site wells out there. So it's a lengthy process to do any sort of modifications to the remedy. Next slide, please. So in terms of our kind of construction highlights or construction by the numbers, we put in 53 new remediation wells. So those are either injection or extraction wells, 75 new monitoring wells, more than 80,000 feet of piping. On any given day during peak of construction, we could have more than 180 workers on site building all these pipelines and wells and everything else. And all of that work was observed by tribal monitors where they chose to be out there, which was most of the time. And, you know, all in all, it's more than 500,000 hours worked with no reportable safety incidents, which we're really proud of. It's a lot of hours and a lot of people, and safety is our priority at PG&E for sure. Next slide, please. So just at a really high conceptual level, this is the optimization that we were talking about earlier in the presentation. And you can see the blue lines and dots are the infrastructure that we think needs to be installed to do this remedy. And the yellow lines and dots are infrastructure that we don't think is necessary anymore. It's just too far away from the plume, frankly. So ultimately, if we don't install all of the yellow dots and lines, we save 8,000 feet of pipeline that doesn't need to be installed in the sacred area, as well as 19 less wells. And it actually cleans up the plume more quickly. So we've been working on this modification process for several years. Like I said, it doesn't occur quickly at this site and takes a lot of input from a lot of different parties. And the next slide, please. Okay, so next I'm just going to talk about how well what we've installed is working to date. Like I mentioned, installation of phase one and starting operation of that IRZ system allowed us to shut off our interim cleanup measures. And so now we're really looking at how well this new system is working. Next slide, please. So the way that we look at this is, you know, we've got our line of injection and extraction wells that are creating this reducing barrier, but then we also have a whole network of monitoring wells that tell us how well is this cleanup going? Are we seeing reductions in chromium concentrations? Are we seeing indicators that the reducing conditions are being created? That sort of thing. And then just basically monitoring to make sure even down gradient towards the river, we're not still seeing, you know, byproducts or hexavalent chromium concentrations. Next slide, please. So this is just an example of two monitoring wells that are near the IRZ injection line and kind of showing how this treatment of the hexavalent chromium occurs. So you can see the top well, MW26, is a little bit closer to the injection wells, but you see that once we start up that IRZ and start creating that reducing environment, we see a really rapid decrease in concentration, you know, going from 2,000 parts per billion to non-detect relatively quickly. And then the next well is a little bit further away. We still see really good treatment. It just basically takes a little bit longer and it's a little harder to get it completely down when you're further away from the IRZ injection wells. But we see really good progress in terms of it just really knocking down these higher concentrations. Next slide, please. So this slide is looking at it from the subsurface. So this is what we call cross-section. And what we're basically looking at is that reducing barrier line over there in pink this time. We're basically looking at it underground. And we're looking at what the actual contaminant plume looks like underground. The darkest color is more than 1,000 parts per billion. Next darkest is greater than 100 parts per billion. And then the lightest color is less than 32 parts per billion, which is our cleanup goal for TOPOC. That was our background number that was determined through our background study and what we are currently cleaning up to. So this is a snapshot before we turned on the IRZ. And if you go to the next slide, please. And this is what it looks like in the fourth quarter of 2023. You can see a big portion of the plume has been completely knocked out to non-detect. The areas that are remaining are actually near our extraction wells. So when you inject ethanol and create this reducing condition, there's a lot of byproducts that get formed that if you pull them into an extraction well, they'll clog it up. And we have a really limited number of boreholes we're allowed to install on this site. So it's really important that we don't lose any of our wells. And so that's why those areas still show elevated concentrations, but they are actively being extracted and treated via the rest of the IRZ wells. So in general, we see really good progress. We're really knocking these things down along this barrier, and we're seeing really strong formation of these reducing conditions. Next slide, please. And, you know, as it says in the title of this presentation, really it's all about protecting the Colorado River. And we have decades of data where we've looked at surface water and sediment data from the river, and we've never had a detection of chromium from our release. So that's really positive. Next slide, please. And then kind of the last item we're going to talk about here is our soil investigation and removal work that's happened at the site. Next slide, please. We've had extensive soil investigation work done at the site. We've looked at, you know, 15 areas outside of the station facility, 27 inside the facility. And based on all that data we collected, extensive risk assessment was conducted. And that led to additional removal actions. So if I get next slide, please. So to date, we've completed two federal removal actions at the site. The first one was back in 2010, which is a time-critical removal action that really just focused on removing debris from PG&E facility and immediately surrounding areas. And then more recently, we're actually just finishing up a non-time-critical removal action, and that's been going on since 2022 and basically allowed us to remove contamination from federal lands or areas where contamination had the potential to migrate onto federal lands. So haven't really touched anything inside the station. This is really focused on the federal land areas. And that ended up with us removing about 33,000 cubic yards of contaminated soil from the site. Next slide, please. And this is just showing, you can see the compressor station in the bottom half of the photo, and then these surrounding areas are where the removal actions were completed. Just something of note, the red and yellow dashed lines are actually the areas that we initially thought we were going to excavate, and the black line shows you how much more we ended up having to excavate as we chased contamination. That was partly due to limitations on the number of soil borings that we could complete as part of these investigations. So the delineation was not as good as you would typically see on a soil removal site. So just, you know, one more added complexity to getting this work done. And then this last two, go one more, please just go half forward. For the groundwater remedy, we're going to work through this modification process, and then one way or another, start construction of phase 2B. So finish building out this full remedy. Then we'll go into a period of O&M for many years. You know, most of our modeling, we're looking in the 30-year timeframe to really see significant cleanup. So this is going to be going on for a long time. And then in terms of soil, you know, we need to update the risk assessment based on the removal actions that we've completed, and then kind of work through the process to get to a record of decision for soil. Ultimately, there's going to be areas on the station that the cleanup won't really get done until the station is no longer active. Things under buildings, that sort of thing. And so that will be ongoing for a very long time as well. So with that, I would open up to any questions that any of you have for me today.
Do we have any questions from the board?
I was just wondering if that the remediation process that you guys came up with, I think is really amazing, to change chrome 6 to chrome 3 underground, right? Could that be utilized in other places, do you think?
Definitely. I mean, so that actually came out of our Hinckley cleanup. We've been doing that for, I could say, 15 years out there, maybe 20 years. And yeah, I think any sort of contaminant that's subject to that reductive process, in Hinckley, it's a farming community, so there's a lot of historical nitrate contamination, and we actually see the IRZs will just get rid of that nitrate, so it reduces it down and comes out of the water.
Is it a fairly expensive process, or is it something that can be utilized?
It's
economically
it's expensive.
That's what I thought. Okay.
I mean, it's really effective at knocking down very high concentrations quickly. If you went with a more traditional pump and treat type method, it would take many, like maybe 100 years longer to see a reduction from like 5,000 parts per billion to under 32, you know. It's a much more lengthy process. So when you're dealing with a project that's on a 30-year type scale and is going to be really expensive anyway, it's worth putting in the investment up front to really knock that down, the mass as quickly as possible, right? Like in a remediation project, it really comes down to mass reduction and how much of that mass that got put into the aquifer can be taken out. And really, I think to me, that's how you show progress on a remediation project.
I was pretty excited when I heard what you guys were doing, because I've been watching this since the early 2000s, and it was getting closer and closer to the river, and every, you know, it was like, so thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any other questions? I have one. So it looks like the plume has already been drastically reduced in just through the initial phase of, the remediation process, and then you're entering into a 30-year O&M phase after it's all done. Is that just to maintain the baseline once it's all cleaned up, or do you expect that these like remaining pockets are going to be very difficult to dislodge?
So we're seeing really effective cleanup right by the river edge where we have that reducing condition, but a large portion of the very high concentration mass exists up by the compressor station. And so really the time is going to be doing all that freshwater injection up in those areas and pushing all that contamination right into the IRZ. And that's the part that takes a long time.
Like how Is there a rate like that it moves through the soil to get to that
upline? God, I don't know. I honestly don't know that off the top of my head, but I will say part of the reason that we need the freshwater injection is that the groundwater gradient is really, really flat at the site. Like it barely moves. And so if you didn't inject to do this push, it would never reach the RZ. I mean, it would take hundreds of years. So this push actually facilitates getting that contamination pushed across more quickly. And I if you really want to know the answer to that question, I have someone on the phone that probably can't answer it, but I don't know that off the top of my head.
Thank you. That was a very informative presentation.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. Moving on to item 7, the board will now hear a report from Executive Officer Paula Rasmussen.
Excuse me, Chair Satin. We do have a person that may want to speak on item 6.
Awesome. Can we just, is that,
yeah,
we can have them up now?
Margaret Gentile.
My person, I can probably tell you now.
Margaret, are you there? And you're.
She's
yeah. Margaret, can you hear me? Yeah, she's
got a raised hand.
Margaret, we're not able to hear you. Maybe check your settings.
Can we maybe revisit after the next item? See if she gets.
I don't think that would be appropriate based on the agenda structure that we have. I suggest that we maybe, perhaps maybe.
I don't think her setup's working, but she said just, you know, let's move on. She was just going to try to answer your question.
Oh. All right. I appreciate the attempt. Thank you.
Okay.
She can hear. Okay, so back to the executive officer report.
Good morning, Chair Satin, members of the board, members of the public. Today, I would like to introduce two new staff members. First, we have Brianna Allen. Brianna, you can stand up. Thank you. She's an engineering geologist working in the land disposal programs. She comes to the Water Board from Cal Portland, where she worked as an environmental and mining geologist intern. She has a degree in engineering geology from San Diego State University, and she started her position here at the beginning of January. We are also joined by Kevin Gonzalez. Kevin is also in the land disposal program, and he's a graduate of UC Davis with a degree in civil engineering. And Kevin comes to us from Geotech, where he worked as an inspector for construction sites. Part of his duties included inspecting water and sewer line installations, and his senior research project at UC Davis looked at ways to treat harmful algal blooms, and Kevin started yesterday. So help me welcome Brianna and Kevin to the Water Board. And the other thing I want to mention is that with the addition of Kevin and Brianna, we are now have three vacancies, all of which are under recruitment. So we've made some progress filling our vacancies. And then as mentioned by board member Firestone, the Salt and Sea Workshop in Sacramento on May 22nd. When an agenda is available, I will be sharing that with everybody. And that concludes my report.
Thank you, Ms. Rasmussen. Any questions from the board? On behalf of all the board members, I'd like to welcome our new staff. We're very excited to have you here and look forward to all sorts of great work. Okay. Item 8, do any board members have anything they'd like to discuss? Okay, moving on, chair's report. I attended the chair's report on March 4th. It was largely logistical, introducing some of the new chairs, including myself, and going over potential topics for discussion in the future. One item of general interest among all participating boards was an update on the environmental justice compliance element that Ms. Firestone alluded to earlier. So I think we're all very excited to see that annual report. And that concludes my chair's report. Council, are there any matters for closed session?
Not today.
Awesome. With that in mind, the next meeting is scheduled for April 9th, 2024, and we are adjourned.
Well done.